Hello and welcome in to the Sight and Sound Technology Podcast. My name is Stuart Lawler. It's National Braille Week, and this is episode number 64. If you'd like to get in touch with us, the email address is podcast@sightandsound.co.uk. We always love to hear from you. It is National Braille Week. It's also going to be World Sight Day on the 13th of October. It's a very busy week here at Sight and Sound, so keep an eye on our social media for lots of different things that will no doubt pop up on your radar. Today, I'll be talking with Roger Furman. He's chair of the UK Association for Alternative Formats, about his life and love of Braille. Stay right where you are. National Braille Week offers a time to raise awareness of Braille and other alternative formats used by blind and low vision people. And we're delighted to mark and celebrate National Braille Week here at Sight and Sound Technology because, of course, we're passionate about Braille. And someone else who's passionate about Braille, and in fact, I couldn't think of a better guest to have for National Braille Week on our podcast today, is Roger Furman. Roger is chair of UCAF, that's the UK Association for Accessible Formats. He's also, up to very recently, run his own business, Golden Cord. He's now enjoying the world of retirement, or at least we hope he is. He is an accomplished musician, has also spent time in his career working in RNIB, and is an avid reader of Braille and, of course, Braille music. Roger, it's lovely to have you on the show. Welcome.
Stuart, thank you very much indeed for having me.
You and I kind of go back a long time. I met you, I was in university, and one of your role, I think, at that time, if I'm not mistaken, with RNIB was to kind of be a champion and to promote and help people who were educating people in music. And at the time I was in first year in college, you came over, and I have to say, and I think we've said it on previous webinars and when you and I have talked, it was hugely helpful. In fact, I think it was crucial for the people who were working with me that time. Were you doing lots of that back in the day?
I wouldn't say that I personally was doing a great deal. My role then was more as music services manager, and we were developing at that time education services and also leisure services. So music within RNIB fell into three of its divisions. It's all obviously changed since because of how structures change and how situations change. But there was an opportunity, there was a need, and it really was a great privilege to have the opportunity to visit you at university and meet some of the staff there. And there was a real desire, I think, on everybody's account to want to ensure that things were in place so that you could maximise your gain from that course. And if there was anything that we could do to help, then that was, you know, hugely important to us. And in some ways, I was thinking about this, it might not always be the practical things, but it's the being there that was, I think, really important, along with the practical aspects. And it was hugely gratifying that you, as you've said elsewhere, that you were extremely generous about that time and how we'd been able to help and the influence it was on you. And I mean, that's really important to me, and, you know, great privilege. We want to help one another. We want to do what we can for one another and helping along life's journey, as it were. And you, as it were, starting out in developing in music and other things, as I know you, and obviously you were doing great work apart from music at UCC. So fantastic. It was a lovely trip, and as I said, a great privilege to be there.
Brilliant. Well, thank you. We'll come back to talk about your time at RNIB and some of the things you were doing, and obviously UCAF in a sec, but can we go right back? Are you blind from birth, or how?
Yes, blind from birth. So Braille, it's like everything else. I really cannot remember what age I started being introduced to Braille, but but it was early. It would have been 3, 4, 5, something like that, definitely. And I can remember learning, you know, some letters and gradually learning to read some of the uncontracted Braille.
Where did the music come in? Were you always interested in music, and was Braille music that kind of natural move as you were learning English Braille?
Well, I think what happens, I was always interested in music, and I can recall making sounds on a piano. I wasn't formally learning the piano at that stage, but music has always been important to me, and I can remember acquiring, in those days when they are still around, LP records are making a comeback.
And they're making a huge comeback, aren't they?
Yeah. They are, yeah. And you know, that's fantastic. So I can remember some of my early LP records, like Solomon playing the Grieg and Schumann Piano Concertos and Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto and various things like that stick in your mind. But after the reading, I can remember when I moved to junior school, age what, 6, something like that, the reality of trying to write Braille was a challenge, because in those days it was writing on a writing frame, a guide, a clamp and a style. And when you wrote Braille in those days, because you wrote with the paper facing down, you were writing your letters in reverse order to how you read them. So dots 1, 2, 3 were on the right and 4, 5, 6 on the left, and then when you turn the paper over, you could read what you'd attempted to write, or what I had attempted to write. So it was the Braille frame to start with. And then I can remember moving on to use a Stainsby, and again there were two versions of that. You had the dots 1, 2, 3 on the right, or 1, 2, 3 on the left. I had a 1, 2, 3 on the left, so it was writing as you read, as it were. And alongside that, I was obviously developing reading skills, and then introduced to Braille music at what, probably age 7, 8, something like that. And it was around the time when bar over bar format was coming in. So I think I was initially, I think that's what I first learned, and there was the ABRSM exams, and the early grades that were done in teacher's copy and pupil's copy. And I can remember the pupil's copy, where you had the bar numbers above and then the right hand and the left hand. So that was all of a gradual introduction to that. And so, yes, that was my first foray into Braille music.
Can you just, because, and that's really interesting, you mentioned bar over bar and bar by bar, of course, which was the older one. Can you maybe explain it for people who mightn't understand? Because there's some people who've only ever read bar over bar, which, of course, is right hand on top and left hand underneath. But back, as you mentioned, when that was introduced, previous to that, it was all on one line, wasn't it?
Well, bar by bar is where it followed the lines, and the only indentations you had where it may say line 1, line 2, line 3 when you got to that point. And bars were divided by a letter L. So what happened, say, for piano music, you had a left-hand sign, then you had your left-hand part followed by the right-hand part. And obviously the basic notation is the same, but rather than trying not to get too technical, but the way that intervals work, intervals read up in both hands, whereas with bar over bar you had intervals reading
down in the right,
in the right hand, and up in the left. And I think the main thinking was that with the reading down, where you had the melody, that would more often, obviously they're huge you know, it's not as clear cut as this, but the melody being at the top and your other intervals reading down would be, so you'd learn the melody from what you were playing as a top note. The other advantage that, well, there are lots of advantages that bar over bar does have, in my view, is that you have your music aligned. So whether it's one bar on a line, two or three bars on a line, you have the right hand, and then it's aligned with the corresponding left hand beneath it. Whereas if you have a long bar over bar left hand, you know, it may extend on to more than one or two lines, and then you get the right answer. If you're really wanting to read in detail what sometimes goes with what, then it gets a bit tricky. So if you're playing chords, for instance, and you want to be sure that it's the third chord in the left hand going with the third chord in the right hand, you might be some distance away in terms of your hands for reading in the bar by bar. But there was a lot of music produced in bar by bar right from the 1930s to the 1960s, and you know that R&B produced a lot of it, and that tended for many years to be the staple of the catalogue, because you don't suddenly end up with all those pieces of music miraculously becoming into bar over bar. You're retranscribing, and obviously those were current editions at the time in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, but some of those go out of fashion, and things change, and you know, things evolve, and so that's part of what happens.
What was it like then? You're 7, 8 years age, 9 years of old, whatever, and I was actually about the same age as you. What was it like for you learning Braille music alongside English? Sometimes people get very anxious about that, and I mean, I'm more so thinking of sighted teachers, and then I see kids just take it in their stride, and someone says, oh, you know, C crotchet, oh yeah, that's like a TH sign, and they think nothing else of it. Was that complicated for you, or did you just go with it?
No, I think you just get on with it. Yeah. You don't think it's I can understand the concerns of people who are not using it, and they think, oh, that's going to be so difficult. But in some ways, if you tell people something's difficult, then it becomes difficult.
Right, right.
I'm not saying there aren't challenges to learning anything. Of course there are challenges, but, you know, you children, I think in many cases, you just get on with it. You just take to it. You don't think about the difficulties. If it's something that you really want to do, and when you grasp the liberation that it can give you, you can read this music on your own, you can learn your pieces on your own, and you can make progress that way, rather than being taught things by memory, you know, by your teacher saying, well, you play this, and then and then well, a week later, can you remember it all, or have you forgotten it? But where you have that independence to do it yourself, that's building to that. That's obviously fantastic.
Someone said to me as well years ago, Roger, and I thought it was a very good point, that if you're always listening and just playing back, you're never really interpreting. At least if you have the Braille score in front of you, Braille piano music, whatever it is, you're able to make some decisions yourself.
You obviously have the music there. You have the independence. You know that if it says in the Braille copy there's a crescendo there, and you're not doing it, you're absorbing that from what you're reading into how you are building your own interpretation of what is there. And you know, that's fantastic. It's wonderful.
Tell me about you know, you finish in school, and did you go on to university, or what was your journey through music?
My journey through then, I left school and studied music privately with an organ and piano teacher, and then I took my first steps into work. What was I going to do? So I, for the first few years of my working life, I was a freelance musician, the organ being my main instrument. Mm-hmm. So I was doing some teaching, playing church services and a few organ recitals and things like that. So that's what I did for up until my time of joining R&IB in 1982 in their music department.
So 1982 in R&IB, again, I suppose Braille music was still relatively niche, was it? I mean, I suppose some people might say it's still niche today, but back then, what sort of stuff were you doing in R&IB to try to support people?
There was a lot of work going on, and I think one of the things over the years has always been the feeling or things that people have said, it's like people saying, oh, well, not many people read Braille, or not many people read Braille music. And when you start digging around, there are far more people doing all these things. And I think I realized we're not pretending that there are millions of Braille readers in the UK around. They're not, but it's like everything else. If Braille is your medium, Braille is your lifeline, that is so important to me, to me and to all of us who use Braille. So Braille music aligned with the fact that I think in the education system, you will know over those years that the more specialist schools were fading out, were closing, and more education was happening within mainstream. So I went to a specialist school, and you just got on with things. You just did, but you learned Braille, you just did things like that. Whereas I think perhaps in the early days, and still maybe the case in some situations, that if you are a child of one in a whole school and you're the only visually impaired child, and the teachers, the staff don't necessarily know Braille and Braille music and other Braille codes as well as people who would have been teaching in the specialist schools, that's, I think, what was a difficulty. But also on the flip side of that, I think there was always more Braille music going on than was statistically gathered in that sense. So I think the music, we were certainly at RNIB, we were certainly producing music that people needed for leisure, and also for those blind teachers who were teaching either blind or sighted students, so in sighted school settings. So the thrust was very much into the usual examination music and exams that were required, people developing careers and going into music, or people using music in many different ways in their lives. And from the social point of view, there was a lot of, and probably still is, a lot of choral singing going on. So it's a great way for people singing in choral societies, choruses, church choirs, to integrate socially with sighted peers, and that they needed resources to be able to do that.
I have very happy memories, by the way. The other thing which I just wanted to mention to you was you used to run, I think, I'm probably thinking of the early 90s, you ran some Saturday events at RNIB. They were sort of themed events. You would have music events, I think, run by the Music Advisory Service. I went to a few of those, flew over with my then piano teacher, a lady called Maeve Smith. And you were doing some kind of interesting things that time. I remember you were introducing talking scores. You were introducing a slightly alternative method of Braille music, a slightly easier method maybe for some people who might have struggled with the current code. And you were also at the time sort of looking at music technology. And I remember thinking, this is where we need to be, looking at what RNIB are doing.
We had really committed people within the various areas of music within RNIB who were doing a whole range of tasks, I say, covering the production of music, the education of music, and the leisure aspects. And music technology was really emerging, wasn't it? And, it's amazing looking back 30 years, what has changed in that time. But you start somewhere. So there were what might be considered today very rudimentary things, but the thing is, at the time, it's like computers. You look back to the days of your BBC computer, and I had one of those in the 80s, and I can remember this great leap into when was I going to leap from a BBC to a PC? And I had a PC, and I did that in the 90s. And things go on, and then, with Windows emerging, how was all that going to be made possible for blind people to use Windows? And then you come along with all the technology and Braille displays and things that we can easily take for granted these days. but not in the sense that they're available to everybody, because obviously the equipment is expensive, and either you need funding for it, and or if you're in employment, you can get use schemes. But there are lots and lots of people who aren't online, and from a choice, because it could be a whole lot of reasons, they may never get to being online, or they're just happy with not, you know, using very simple forms of technology. But the technology, it was fantastic, and obviously that opened up and has opened up great areas of being able to involve blind people in creating music with you know, many of the systems are now around, and either separately from or in addition to Braille music. So there's a lot that has been developing over years, and a lot that is available now. And things, you know, technology is really kind of just taking greater and greater importance in our lives. And for some, that might be very troubling, and for others, it's very liberating. So it depends where you are on that scale. But the technology is here, and we can take huge advantage of it. And if it can be used to create more things that we want to do, more Braille music, and for reading either in hard copy or on Braille displays, then excellent. And I know you're a great, obviously with your work, you're very much into technology, aren't you, Stuart?
Well, yeah, and look, I suppose it's and you've made a good point about sort of people use it in different ways, and I think technology needs to work for people and you know to use it on their terms as well.
Yeah.
You left RNIB to go and set up your own business, Golden Chord, and you were doing music transcription. I remember when you emailed me a couple of months ago to say that you were closing up the business, that you were going to retire. And I remember reading it going, you know, it's really nice for Roger that he's going to retire, but it's, I think, a big loss that this transcription service was closed down, because, again, it's very specialised. Not many people doing this stuff in the UK. Were you busy with Golden Chord?
Yes, I was, and there comes a time in life, and it's, you know, you think, do I want to do this for the next however many years may be granted to me? And obviously we don't know how many that is. And I came to a conclusion that I thought, actually, this is a good time to stop. There's never an ideal time to stop because of people that one is very conscious. I was very conscious of trying to ensure that the customers were receiving materials that they needed. And, you know, you can think of particularly, but not exclusively, particularly, say, people working as professional musicians who did need a lot of material reasonably quickly, because there is so much more printed music out there than we will ever likely be able to produce in Braille. But it was very important to be able to ensure that they had the Braille so that they could teach their sighted pupils, that they could do what they wanted. And I, you know, if you can think of a case where Golden Chord produced a lot of orchestral parts for, you know, for an instrument, as it were, so that they could participate in orchestra and in you know, playing Beethoven symphonies in orchestras, because they had their own music and were able to learn the part, and frankly, in many cases, know it far better than their sighted colleagues. Those that have the advantage, if you tend to solely rely on sight reading, as a blind musician, if you're using Braille, you tend to know the score a lot better, because you've had to absorb the detail and spent time learning it. It's these are the hidden things that people might not realise, that yes, you have to commit this all to memory. You're not complaining about it, but it's very different to being able to open open a printed book, and if you're a good sight reader, read it off the page and go from there. But yes, so as I say, there's never a right time to stop. But I really, really hope that we are getting much closer to some of the automated developments with transcribing printed music into Braille. The problem is that this has been going on for years and years and years, and I can remember sitting in my office one day at RNIB, and it would have been in the early 90s, and somebody rang me up and said, oh, I could write a Braille music translation program in 2 weeks. And I said,
off you go.
And I look forward to hearing from you in 2 weeks. Needless to say, we'll never.
You're still waiting on that call.
Still waiting on that call. But the problem has been, I think, over the years, that as computer technology has come online more and more and more, people have pushed out the boat much, much too far, making promises or saying, oh, you'll be able to have all the music you ever needed. And that, of course, raises expectations unrealistically, so that you then let people down, and that's very disappointing. But I think if we really can get to a stage where the quality is going to be much better, the technology is around, and we should be getting more, we should be able to be able to get much closer to making things far more possible than has hitherto been the case. I don't think people should put all their eggs in one basket and just solely rely on the technology. I think there will be cases where, as people who have done for years and years and years, you get music dictated to and you write it down in your own way, your own shorthand, because it means that you have access to that music rather than necessarily having to wait for even a few weeks or whatever the period of time is to receive the hard copy Braille of it. I think you need a whole lot of tools in the armory.
We spoke on this podcast in August to Dr. Sarah Morley Wilkins from the Daisy Consortium. Of course, they're doing really interesting stuff on a whole load of levels to automate Braille music production, but also, probably more interestingly, from where you and I are sitting, Roger, to allow people who are visually impaired, screen reader users, to create their own music scores using Braille input. It's fascinating stuff, and very exciting to see where that goes. Tell us, you've gone into retirement, but you're potentially maybe busier. We were just saying off air before, but you're busier than ever. You're chair of UCAF. You have been for a couple of years. And maybe for people who don't know, maybe just to tell us a little bit about what UCAF does, because of course this is all formats, and it's not just Braille music. You're an advocate and a champion for so many things with your UCAF hat on.
Well, UCAF was formed, it seems hardly possible, back in 2008, and brought together a number of organisations doing separate things. There was the organisation specifically looking at Braille, responsible for Braille in the UK. There was another one looking at tape services, and then there was an organisation of Braille producers. And at that time it was felt that perhaps if there was one organisation, it would put things under one umbrella. So UCAF was formed in 2008 and obviously has been developing since. And we have various, what we call within the association, subject areas. So we have a Braille subject area, which has a couple of groups. There's a general Braille group and a Braille coding group. We have other areas that have, over the years, have done things with large print, with audio, and a whole range of other formats. And these have obviously been changing over the years as things have become more digital. So there's now obviously a much greater need to ensure that accessibility to all these formats is made as easy as possible. So we encourage, we are a small organisation, but we do get calls. How do we convert this document? How can we, what processes can we use to do this so that it can easily be made into Braille, large print, audio, digital, etc., etc. And a lot of people have been, you know, giving extremely generously of their time over the years, and inevitably people come and go because that's the way of life. And one thing within the charity sector, UCAF is a registered charity in the UK, is, and the whole charity sector, we all need more people to help us to do the work. The charity sector, we know, is so important in the UK and also obviously in Ireland too, Stuart. And we want to promote and get to the point where a lot of the things that we have to do, we would like them to be just come part and parcel of everyday life. So in an organisation, producing a document, and people might say, oh, it's difficult, it's or whatever, how do we do it? We want to get to the stage where it just happens or can happen, not as an add-on, and get away from it being seen as maybe a bit specialist or a bit special. We want these things to become part and parcel of daily life, and so that helps on so many levels.
Without accessibility, because sometimes people think accessibility is boring, don't they? Oh, I have to make a whole load of changes. And you don't if you design from the start.
Exactly. And it's accessibility and usability. I always say to people, you can look at a website and I might be able to read, I might be able to find it accessible. I might not always be able to find it usable.
Right,
so
right.
Those two things have to go in hand. But you're absolutely right. It's we want to get away from this thing that people think, oh, we've got to make all these extra accommodations. We've got to put all these tags in the document. Oh, dear, I could be doing something else. Rather than thinking, actually, if we do this, we are making this document available to far more many people, not just disabled people, but there could be people who might not necessarily wish to categorize themselves as people who could benefit from large print, but with the technology, if they have the file in a format they can use, they can interact with, and they can manipulate it and use it as suits them. And obviously in your line of work, Stuart, you probably come across this quite often.
Absolutely. And it's all about, as you say, that culture of, you know, sure, like, why wouldn't you create something that's accessible for everyone? And it's not just blind low vision. There's all sorts of other reasons you would do it as well. Roger, I suppose, you know, when we have days or weeks to celebrate or to mark things like Braille, in this case, we're talking National Braille Week. It's a time when we tend to reflect, isn't it? I know I certainly, I kind of guess I think a bit more about Braille than I would normally. And as you reflect, I suppose, with your UCAF hat on, and maybe just as well as a Braille user, are you confident? Are you positive? Do you feel positive about the future of Braille as a standalone format, but also about how it will sort of merge in with all the other things that are thrown into our lives, especially technology?
I do. I feel really positive about it. And I'm not just saying that because you think, oh, well, I better say something positive because it's National Braille Week. There's so much work going on in activities of Braille, trying to improve, for instance, how graphics are displayed on Braille displays and things like that. And if you're reading a book that's been published electronically, there's a huge lot of work going on with publishers in the UK, publishers all around the world, to improve things, to use technology. And if you're going to interact with that on a Braille device, an electronic Braille device, your book, depending what it is, may have lots and lots of different things in it. It could have, you know, it's not necessarily just going to have text. It could have lots of images, so you need to know about the images. So there is a lot of work going on in different parts of the world and through the International Council on English Braille, for instance, and linking in with which covers countries in the English-speaking world, of course, and the various organisations in many countries working on so many different things, how to improve, whether it's Braille embossers, Braille displays, improving access to content. I really do remain positive. There's a lot, always a lot to do. You never get to the end because there's always something else to do. Something else has come along. Technology's developed, and you know, I could foresee into the future that the whole way that perhaps that we get information geographically or locally on maps, and how all that is produced, apart from the really, really good work that is being done with interactive technology, you know, such as NaviLens, for instance. Obviously, there are other companies as well doing things, but I just illustrated in as much as the work that, you know, you yourselves at Sight and Sound are doing, and you know, you have a long proud history of, you know, not rooted in the history, but you know, bringing products to market, working in that area, and how important that is. I guess you must remain positive. I do, and you probably see it from a user point of view, as we are, but also from your working perspective within Sight and Sound.
It's really I agree. One of the things I've certainly found and chatted with people about this over the last little while is that the pandemic, I think, kind of did Braille a favor, because certainly from the perspective of working with people at home, working with people on Zoom, and maybe engaging a little more with parents who were a little bit more connected in with Braille because they had to be to support their children. I think it kind of got people a bit more excited. So I would agree with you. I think the future is definitely bright. Roger, I want to thank you very much for taking the time today to chat to us, to help us celebrate National Braille Week. But I think as well, I want to finish as we started and just thank you personally for what you did all those years ago. And I suspect there are other people listening to the podcast whom you helped in the past. So let's say a collective thank you to you, and wish you all the very best in the years ahead. I've no doubt this is not the last we're going to hear from you. We're going to stay in touch, and I'm sure you're going to be inputting into all sorts of things in the future.
Stuart, thank you very much indeed. It's extremely generous of you, and do carry on the work. I know you will, and there's a fantastic journey ahead for everybody. So thank you.
Thanks, Roger. Take care. My thanks to Roger Furman. I thoroughly enjoyed catching up with Roger, and it's lovely to be able to reflect with someone, I think, and think about, well, where we've come and where we are now and where we can go to in this exciting time of Braille. You can find more information, by the way, on UKAF by going to www.ukaf, that's ukaaf.org. That's the website of the UK Association for Accessible Formats. But that's just about all for this show. Happy Braille Week from Stuart Lawler and everybody at Sight and Sound Technology. Take care and talk to you soon.